Campus FM jippreżenta taħdita organizzata mill-Caritas, Kummissjoni Djoċesana Familja u l-Moviment Takana. Is-suġġett huwa For a Marriage Friendly Future. Din il-lecture saret minn Dr. Samantha Callan.
It is with great pleasure for me to introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. Samantha Callan. Dr. Callan is recognized as an expert in the field of family relationships and work-life integration. She provides research services to voluntary sector organizations and industry, and advises politicians and policy makers from across the political spectrum on family issues. Currently, she chairs the Family Breakdown Working Group of the UK Conservative Party's Social Justice Policy Commission and has recently published two major reports for them. She works inter alia with Care for the Family, a major UK charity, and with international family agencies as a consultant researcher. An honorary research fellow at Edinburgh University, she is engaged in primary research into long-term marriage and committed relationships. Working from a background in social anthropology, she holds a master's degree from the Universities of Cambridge and Nottingham and a PhD from the University of Loughborough. Her doctoral research analyzed cultural change in organizations as a result of implementation of family-friendly policies, and she works with firms who are implementing such policies. She has published in peer-reviewed journals and elsewhere, and has spoken at national and international conferences on marriage research, family studies, and the role of policies in affecting cultural change. She regularly contributes to debates on family structure, prevention of family breakdowns, and post-separation issues in local and national media. She is also a frequent speaker at House of Commons seminars and on these and other related subjects. She has been married since 1988 to Mr. Callan and has two children. Dr. Callan is not a Catholic, and notwithstanding this, she has been appointed a member of the Family Marriage Catholic Commission. And I give to you, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Callan. Thank you.
Your graces, ladies and gentlemen, I was asked to speak today about the fact that in spite of high rates of divorce and separation, healthy and united marriages do exist in England and Europe today. Now, I was delighted to be able to launch off from such a positive starting point. The psychologist Dr. Janet Reibstein refers to lifelong fulfilling relationships as the best kept secret. Somebody's already mentioned that today. And for the people she studied, she said, being in a marriage-like partnership is the central, transformational, and ever-replenishing relationship of their lives. She describes in great detail many different relationship stories, and she sums up the approach of one long-term couple, saying, instead of perfect contentment, they strive for pragmatic, imperfect solutions. She claims, every individual love story today pivots around the same conundrums, the tensions between individual freedom and commitment, the task of regenerating mutual interest and desire in the teeth of predictability and routine, the need for security and stability against the push for novelty and the sheer difficulty of the economy of time and energy for each other within two complex lives, all these over increasingly long lives. And over two decades ago, Burgess observed that we tend to have an idealized conception of marriage in the family. It's often portrayed as a romantic and intimate oasis. In reality, it is often an intimate battleground. Mutual investment in one another generates its own risks and pains, and many find it hard to keep taking these risks, and the pain can seem too great to bear. There are many reasons why partnerships end, but a high divorce society itself, as we have, brings pressures. There often seems to be little incentive to keep going when close friends whose marriages we went to called a day, moved on, find the person who really makes them happy. Now, I do rowing marathons. Perhaps I should say quarter marathons. Let me explain. I met someone at my gym who does full rowing marathons. That's 42,000 metres in order to raise money for charity. He's managed to achieve the world's fifth fastest time, but he's actually a pretty ordinary bloke, and I suspect that's because not many people do rowing marathons. He trains hard, but he admits he should eat a bit less, get a bit more sleep, and it is his stamina and determination which makes the difference. So he's very ordinary, that's the point. Anyway, I used to do just a couple of thousand metres at the end of my workout, but thought, I'm going to join him on his next marathon, which meant training a bit harder, even though I was only going to do, as I say, this 10,500 quarter marathon. It's not an officially recognised distance, unlike the half marathon, but I felt it was realistic given the amount of time I have to train, etc. Anyway, after a quiet bit of solo training, I was managing 6,000 or 7,000 metres, but I'd hit a bit of a ceiling. What made all the difference is when I started to train with my marathon rower friend. He helped me with my rather ineffectual technique, and he showed me a few exercises to break up the long haul. But the main thing was that he was on the next rower, keeping going for more than an hour at a time, and just being around someone else who was slogging it out was the spur for me to keep going. This really brought home to me how important it is to be around other people who are persevering with their relationships. That's why we need a pro-marriage culture across Europe. We need a culture which acknowledges the benefits of long-term stable relationships and doesn't skate over the differences that tend to exist between marriage and cohabitation. We need role models who can pass on a few tips to younger couples or those who are going through a rough patch. We need to see people gritting their teeth and saying, this is worth sticking with because better times are coming. And this has a foundation in research. Professor Linda Waite found that those trapped in unhappy marriages are better off not getting divorced, but when couples who'd stayed married 5 years after really struggling their marriage, they were actually statistically more likely to be happy than those who'd thrown in the towel, little British expression there, called it a day, and decided to get a divorce. So all of what I'm saying today is research-based. This is not moralising, this is not just anecdotes. I'm trying to draw on all the research that's been done internationally to give a real solid foundation to what you know to be true. And in fact, 8 out of 10 of these very unhappy couples reported that they were happily married 5 years later. So it wasn't just 5.5, it was 8 out of 10. Now, I am not talking today about keeping people in abusive relationships, but a recent UK survey of 3,500 divorcees found 40% had grown apart. 18% said the magic has gone, and only 13% blamed domestic violence. An American study suggests 80% of divorce is due to growing apart. Because the emphasis now tends to be all on the quality of the relationship. Quality is important, but we all know that it kind of fluctuates a little with mood, tiredness, life circumstances. There has to be more to sustain a relationship than what Professor David Poppenhoe calls the thin and unstable reed of affection. Going back to Janet Reibstein, she's often asked by social scientists and journalists, should we all expect relationships to be temporary and also unfaithful? And she says, I find myself shocked, not to mention irritated, that there is such ignorance regarding the insatiable, ongoing, time-honoured and even animal need to be in a happy, secure, erotic and deepening union with one other person. We may not be skilled at getting there. We obviously lack the secret to having them. But the evidence of partnership breakdown does not convince me, this is Janet Reibstein, that we do not strive for or want desperately to have lasting and wonderful relationships. What I want to do today is make it clear why we need to establish that marriage is still a meaningful institution. To talk about the changes in our perceptions of marriage, which are making it harder to sustain. And I'll describe how marriage tends to differ, as I say, from cohabitation. What is it about marriage anyway? Then I want to describe what's happening in countries like mine, which are ignoring family structure and concentrate on almost exclusively on improving outcomes for children. That is our policy focus in Britain. And finally, I'll talk briefly about how social policy can support rather than undermine relationships. In other words, change the emphasis slightly, not neglect children at all. So why are we having to state unambiguously that marriage is still intensely important to individual families and wider society when you might all think it's pretty obvious? Well, over the last 40 years, we have seen dramatic shifts in our social trends. And although Europe is fairly diverse, there's 46 countries in Europe, there are key similarities such as postponement. In general, with some exceptions, key demographic events, especially those leading to the formation of new households and families, have been postponed in the lives of men and women. So in the new millennium, leaving the parental home, forming a new union, getting married, becoming a parent, are experienced on average later than before. In fact, some countries, mostly in southern Europe, have been characterized by extreme levels of postponement, experiencing the so-called latest late pattern of transition to adulthood. And some events like motherhood have been postponed to ages not observed in the past. So something new is going on. And this general trend towards postponement is also accompanied by an increasing de-standardization of life courses. In other words, people in general are having fewer children later in life, there are fewer and later marriages, more breakdown, more non-marital union, children born outside marriage, smaller households, more living alone, strikingly more children living with one parent, fewer couples with children. But let me just unpack this kind of dry and dusty term, de-standardization of life courses, for you with a quote from a historian, Professor Stephanie Kuntz, wrote a book on the history of marriage very recently. She says, "I have spent much of my career as a historian explaining to people that many things that seem new in family life are actually quite traditional. And I still believe that when it comes to any particular practice or variation on marriage, there's really nothing new under the sun. But when we look at the larger picture, it is clear that the social role and the mutual relationship of marriage, divorce, and singlehood in the contemporary world is qualitatively different from anything to be found in the past. Almost any separate way of organizing family life has been tried by some society at some point in time. But the coexistence in one society of so many alternative ways of doing all of these different things, and this is the key thing, and the comparative legitimacy accorded to many of them has never been seen before. That's what's challenging the normative status of marriage. In other words, the idea that marriage provides a life script in the way it did in the middle of the 20th century when people left home to get married, and marriage marked the beginning of adult life. It's things being treated as it's all the same, really. That's what's different. That's what's never been seen before. So when people say, oh, we had lower rates of marriage in the past, yes, but there's still this value. It was still seen as being different. Yet when looking at the research, at attitudes towards marriage and the family across Europe, it is clear that the family and marriage itself are highly valued across the continent. Large majorities within each country recognize the legitimacy of marriage as a social institution. Professor Abelard, from Malta, in fact, found that the greatest support from the institution of marriage is recorded in Malta, closely followed by the post-communist EU countries, the other neighboring Mediterranean countries, and Sweden, funnily enough. Slightly less support is found in the original EU countries, places like Ireland and Britain, perhaps some surprises there. And also, with the exception of Sweden, most respondents from the other European countries think that a long-term relationship is important for a happy life. and that children need both parents to grow up happily. This is what the grassroots across Europe feel. However important marriage is to grassroots couples, however, many European elites are wary about marriage, rather wedded to the notion that alternative, long-lasting, stable, family-type relationships, what a mouthful, will have to suffice given our social trends. They'll just have to do, in other words. And given their own biographies, the media, policymakers, many politicians find it incredibly hard and in many cases politically dangerous to be overtly in favour of marriage. And that ambivalence is partly responsible for the impression that marriage is declining in importance and possibly even on the way out. I want to look briefly at where this ambivalence comes from. Laura Tennant, writing in the London New Statesman, describes the liberal left orthodoxy on marriage. She says, ever since Marx and Engels described marriage as a patriarchal structure to secure the legitimacy of children and the safe transfer of property between generations, the left has viewed marriage, along with church and state, as an instrument for social control. They prefer to think of it as historically contingent, socially constructed. In other words, it's kind of just arrived or recently arrived. Yet, as Bob Simpson, an anthropologist at Durham University, states, heterosexual monogamy is an enduring basis for constructing social orders the world over. On a social and biological level, that pattern of marriage is a stable one that has cropped up in different times and places. This speaks for marriage not as some kind of artificial template or a recent invention, but as a primal relationship meeting a profound human need. This is Laura Tennant, as I say. This is a secular writer. She goes on, the sexual revolution opened up the possibility of a lifetime of free-flowing erotic liaisons and the undesirability, if not impossibility, of confining one's activities to a single partner. Later, radical feminism argued marriage is just an arena for the economic and sexual exploitation of marriage. Now, more recently, she says, the emphasis on individual fulfillment has worked against the compromises that marriage entails, and our longer lifespan makes till death us do part a promise ever harder to keep. Now, let me just deal with these last two developments, which have questioned the ongoing validity of marriage. Firstly, the notion that marriage exploits women. I'd agree with a commentator called Anastasia Duval, who's the head of family and education at the London-based think tank Civitas. She says, the worry now for campaigners for women's rights should be the close connection between cohabiting partnerships and lone parenthood. In the past 30 years, the number of both cohabiting and lone parent families has rocketed. It is no coincidence that these two have risen simultaneously. While 70% of children born within marriage can still expect to live with both natural parents until 16, that is the case for just 36% of those born into a cohabiting relationship. The instability of cohabitation is sold as freedom, but essentially this fragility has become a new form of women's enslavement. That women can today parent alone and unstigmatized, is a triumph. But this is blighted by the reality of lone motherhood. Some middle-class single mums are having a ball, but they are the minority. There is nothing empowering about being left penniless holding a baby. Around half of lone mothers have no earned income. They scrape by on welfare. Of those who aren't officially poor, many have to do the jobs of two people. And we see that in our society. That is the reality. One in two lone parent families are on income support compared to one in 30 couple parent families. Lone parents have twice as much risk of experiencing persistent low income as couples with children. They are 8 times as likely, and this is understandable, to live in a workless household as couples with children. And that contributes to the fact that the UK has the highest rate of children living in workless households in Europe. Now, serious academics say it is possible to have high rates of lone parenthood without all these disadvantages, and they look to Scandinavia. But that's the UK's lone parent profile is very different to countries like Norway and Sweden. Their lone parents tend to be older than ours. They're less likely to lack physical and emotional resources. Single parents in the UK with all of these attributes, more education, etc., do manage far better, it's true, but it's not just about increasing benefits. Money matters, but it is not the whole story. Now, nearly half of our lone parent households were formed after divorce, so we cannot treat marriage as a magic bullet. Our divorce rates are high, but they have stabilised. However, there are other countries who are still on the upward curve of divorce. So why are marriages failing? Now this takes me on to the second development, the emphasis on individual fulfilment. Let me just kind of wind back the clock a bit to the beginning of the 20th century. Childbearing outside of marriage, cohabitation and same-sex marriage are the result of long-term trends which include two great changes in the meaning of marriage. And to see these trends in the grand sweep of history, I must go back even earlier and remind you that for thousands of years, marriage can organise people's lives in the economic and political hierarchy of society and serve many political, social and economic functions, and the individual needs and desires of its members, especially women and children, were secondary considerations. Love was considered a very poor reason to get married. I'm not saying I agree with it, but let's just set this in context. However, in the 18th century, the revolutionary new ideal of the love match triumphed in most of Western Europe and North America, and this represented a break with literally thousands of years of history. The private relational side of marriage became increasingly important, the public side less so, but both are necessary. Commitment has been described as the glue of relationship. Certain kinds of glue, have you got bostic in this? No, araldite in this country. Yes. They come in two separate tubes, don't they? There's the adhesive and the harder. You mix them together to form a strong bond. And the forces that are internal, that's the relationship. And external, that's public ceremony and status. Like the adhesive and the harder, they work together. So we can't say one's important, the other isn't. They work together. Now, getting back to more recent history, this emphasis on emotional satisfaction and romantic love intensified early in the 20th century. And the change in the meaning of marriage was famously labelled the transition from institutional marriage to marriage as a companionship. Now, during this first change in meaning, marriage was still the only socially acceptable way to have a sexual relationship, to raise children in much of the industrialised world, possibly with the exception of the Nordic countries. And this era was labelled the era of mandatory marriage from about 1850 to 1960. Then, during the last few decades of the 20th century, an ethic of, let me say this slowly, expressive individualism, the belief that each person has a unique core of feeling and intuition that should unfold or be expressed if their individuality is to be realised, this became more important, and more than has ever been the case, the emotional satisfaction of the spouses became an important measure for marital success. Beginning in the 1960s, marriage's dominance began to diminish, and this second great change in the meaning of marriage occurred. An even more individualistic perspective on the rewards of marriage took root. And when people evaluated, well, how satisfied am I with my marriage? They began to think more in terms of the development of their own sense of self, the expression of their feelings. And that was the transition from the companionate marriage to what we might call the individualized marriage. And you may have heard of sociological theorists like Anthony Giddens, who also writing about individualization, they talk about the declining power of social norms as regulating mechanisms for family life. and they stressed the expanding role of personal choice, the great mantra of choice. They argue that as traditional sources of identity, such as class, religion, and community, lose influence, one's intimate relationships become central to self-identity. Giddens writes of the emergence of the pure relationship, an intimate partnership entered into for its own sake, which lasts only as long as both partners are satisfied with the intimacy and love that they get from it. Now, Mike Mason, a Christian who wrote The Mystery of Marriage, puts all these things in slightly less complimentary terms. He says, the modern idea of marriage sees love as a vehicle for self-fulfillment and talks of the importance of preserving one's individual identity, respecting differences, and the freedom to be me. These are important concepts, but they are easily twisted into propaganda for selfishness. The cramming of personhood into the narrow box of ego, as if a person were nothing more than his own conscious urges and desires. But that is exactly what marriage works against. It attacks self-centeredness in all its disguises, simultaneously, tirelessly, throwing the ego off balance. Our identity is not something we take into a relationship, but it's what we draw out of it. It's something we don't have at all unless we discover it through reciprocity with others. And a good way to look at the implications of this are to see it in terms of its impact on commitment. The pure relationship is what is called an ideal type, something we seem to be heading for towards as a society, as evidenced by increased cohabitation and living apart together. Now, research on cohabiting couples, which asks them, well, how do you view your relationship? It tends to produce the response, we're just as committed as marrieds. But subsequent breakup rates do question this. Cohabitees do not tend to admit they're less committed, but it's really important to look at what does commitment involve if we can appreciate how it underpins relationships in modern society. A sociologist called Michael Johnson brought the concept of commitment into three dimensions. There's structural commitment, feeling one has to continue a relationship because of constraint from external pressures, such as marriage vows, and other people's disapproval. There's moral commitment, feeling one ought to continue a relationship because of one's own value system, not necessarily just from a religious viewpoint, but a culturally rooted sense that marriage is for life, or that when kids are involved, it can't simply be severed purely for personal gratification. And finally, personal commitment, a feeling one wants to continue the relationship, because it is satisfying and pleasurable. So the pure relationship, which lasts only as long as both partners are satisfied, is held together by personal commitment only. Whereas relationships based on the notion that marriage is for life and everything reasonably possible should be done to preserve the union are strengthened by the marshalling of structural and moral commitment. But let me just illustrate how marriage, if run along pure relationship lines, can falter by reading a news clipping of a uniquely 21st century scenario. Couple divorce after online affair. A Bosnian couple are getting divorced after finding out that they've been secretly chatting each other up online under false names. Now, I haven't a hope of pronouncing these names correctly. Sana and her husband Adnan from Zenica poured out their hearts to each other over their marriage troubles. Both felt that they'd found their real soulmate. The couple met in an online chat room and started chatting under the names of Sweetie and Prince of Joy. They eventually decided to meet, but there was no happy ending when they realized what had happened. This picture is courtesy of the Humour Archives. That's my copyright, looking after copyright. So they both met, and now they are both filing for divorce, with each accusing the other of being unfaithful. Sana said, I thought I'd found the love of my life. The way this Prince of Joy spoke to me, the things he wrote, the tenderness in every expression was something I'd never had in my marriage, and this is the bloke she's married to. Oh. It was amazing. We both seemed to be stuck in the same kind of miserable marriages, and how right that turned out to be. We arranged to meet outside a shop. Both of us would be carrying a single rose so that we'd know each other. And when I saw my husband there with the rose, and it dawned on me what had happened. I was so shattered. I felt so betrayed. I was so angry. And her husband said, I was so happy to have found a woman who finally understood me. Then it turned out I hadn't found anyone new at all. It wasn't a new person. To be honest, I still find it hard to believe that the person, sweetie, who wrote such wonderful things to me on the internet is actually the same woman I married and who hasn't said a nice word to me for years. So we can't be smug, happy and satisfied about married. But across Europe, statistically, you are far more likely to part if you're cohabiting. And when children are part of the picture, our statistics, British ones, show nearly one in two cohabitees will have parted before the child is five, compared to one in 12. Staggering. So with non-marital relationships, fragility not just comes with the territory, it's seen as almost inevitable and an evolutionary development, a sign of progress. And the public policy emphasis on separating amicably, making contact arrangements satisfactory for both parents, that's where the emphasis is, keeping conflict to a minimum. Now, keeping conflict to a minimum is highly appropriate because the key issue for children's well-being is the level of conflict between their parents, not, by the way, the level of happiness. So Booth and Amato in the States found that high conflict marriages are as damaging to children as low conflict divorces. Children who don't see their parents' divorces coming either blame themselves or internalize the assumption that relationships are inherently unreliable. And Elizabeth Marquardt's research indicates that such children, even when their parents have a best case scenario separation, so there's regular unconflicted contact or residence with both parents, they often experience significant levels of inner conflict which dominate their childhood and continue into adulthood. They feel pushed to the sides of their parents' lives as mum and dad struggle to reorder their lives after separation. And this is what I find very poignant, the inner conflict which arises in children when they struggle internally to make sense of the differing value systems which their own parents found impossible to reconcile. So it shifts, the responsibility of that shifts to the children. Many reported a sense they'd had to grow up too soon. Their childhood was characterized by loneliness. And these more subtle effects of separation, which haven't resulted in childhood depression or severe behavioral problems, which do affect a minority, have been termed sleeper effects. They become most evident when people leave home and try to form lasting relationships themselves. Now, Marquardt doesn't argue no one should ever get divorced or separated, or that divorced, separated people are morally reprehensible, nor does she deny the resiliency perspective, that is, that most children of separated parents do develop into well-adjusted, successful adults. But there are these hidden internal fault lines. So you seem to be coping well, but there's things going on the inside. Now, her contention is that the debate has been dominated by the adult perspective, and that despite the necessary concern we must continue to show for parents themselves, this should not prevent us from looking unflinchingly at the experience of children of separation. Now, if policy only looks at helping people pick up the pieces after breakdown and fails to do enough to prevent it from happening in the first place, this shows inadequate regard for the impact on children and adults of the severing, of the cutting of a close emotional bond. Family breakdown costs the UK 13.5 billion Maltese lira each year. Yet our government spends 1/5,000th of that amount on prevention. Since January 2006, as mentioned already, I have, as an independent academic, been advising the current opposition Conservative Party on measures to build a more stable society. And last July, we produced a report with a significant body of well-researched policies to help prevent, but also to help those who are struggling with the aftermath of family breakdown. So prevent, but also help for those who are caught up in it. We recommended that an incoming government set up a national relationship and parenting education voucher scheme for couples and parents at key stages of life. This would entail 9 streams of relationship and parenting education programmes operated partly by the voluntary sector and accessed through things like doctor surgeries, health visitors and those conducting civil weddings. Now, we said any attempt to reverse the long-term trend of increasing family breakdown must be backed by serious long-term strategies. And this scheme represents a radical step change in our national approach towards improving relational competence. Services would reach 800,000 families every year once full capacity within the voluntary sector had been reached. And evidence from United States programs indicates a high take-up, positive effects, so that's lower conflict, higher satisfaction, lower divorce risk, and surprisingly, younger, low-income service users were more, not less, likely than others to report an interest in relationship education. They want to do something. Now, let me just tell you about a UK initiative run by the voluntary sector, which would expand greatly with the government backing we propose. Now, when couples talk about the preparations they make for marriage, they're in the UK, they're probably referring to the dress fittings, the choice of hymns, ordering the flowers, the cake, the invitations. It seems like an endless list. Our weddings cost something like 16,000 a year, 12,000 lira, massive expense. But as the author of the book Rules of Engagement says, planning a wedding is one of the most exciting and potentially exhausting projects many people ever embark on, but the wedding day is just the beginning. What happens after the speeches, cutting the cake, the honeymoon? She says, building a strong marriage is not just about marrying the right person, however much we love them. It involves choice, commitment, acquiring skills, developing habits that will lay strong foundations for the future. And our government has been advised to fund or at least endorse marriage preparation for more than a decade. For example, a 1998 consultation paper recommended that registrars signpost engaged couples towards marriage preparation, and it almost but didn't quite become government policy. But as I say, the voluntary sector in the form of something called the National Couple Support Network has stepped in. It's aiming to provide coordinators in every registration district who can make it possible for couples to access wedding prep within the church and without. Now, a lack of government support for marriage preparation is discouraging many of these registrars who conduct civil weddings from working with these coordinators. So even if the voluntary sector is delivering incredible services like Kana on Malta, the impact will be limited without a significant level of resource and explicit, frankly stated government support, especially when something like marriage preparation or relationship education is that little bit culturally unacceptable. Now, people easily associate services like this with personal inadequacy. But if senior politicians and community leaders said that they'd learned something from marriage enrichment, that would start to affect cultural change. So when they recommend it to the rest of the country, they're not saying, go along to this, you need help. But they're saying, perhaps, like a car needs a service, all of our marriages need some input. We've tried it, why don't you? Now, we have, as I said, to live out the paradox. We do all we can to help people make their relationships work and all we can to help them pick up the pieces if it all goes wrong. Marriage itself is full of paradox, truths held in tension. Let me illustrate this point with a few more quotes from The Mystery of Marriage I was mentioning earlier. Love specializes in the destruction of the human ego. If people understood the true depths of self-abnegation, that's kind of having to humble oneself, that marriage demands, there would perhaps be far fewer weddings. Marriage would be seen as a form of suicide. Ooh. Marriage cannot help being a furnace of conflict, a crucible in which two wills must be melted down and purified and made to conform. Marriage is not for the faint-hearted. And when I wrote these policy proposals, I was careful never to talk about incentivizing or pushing people into marriage, but always to use the word support. People should not be incentivized to tether themselves for life to someone unless they are fully aware of what they're doing. Now, I know I'm an academic, and I always say more research needs to be done. But another of our policy recommendations was the setting up of a new Marriage and Relationships Institute to kind of organise our preventative programmes, but also to commission a major research programme into what makes marriages and families work. Now, we recommended this because although we have an excellent Family and Parenting Institute in the UK, the current family policy emphasis always defaults to helping people with parenting. So those opposed to policies supporting marriage often say, what matters to kids is the quality of parenting. There can be good parenting in any family type, married, cohabiting, single, etc. And obviously this is true. But it ignores the fact that good parenting is more likely and far more easier to achieve in some family types than others. As one commentator says, whilst there is ample evidence that the quality of parental relationships is a crucial social factor for children, politicians, policymakers, and practitioners are wary of adult relationships. So it's the quality of the relationships between the parents. People acknowledge that it's terribly important how parents get on with each other, but they're wary of doing anything about it. Now, this wariness reflects the fact that in this area, perhaps more than any other, politicians, policymakers, and academics, among others, are aware of their own frailty. Many of their own families have endured some form of family breakdown, and they are understandably determined not to moralise. They're also reluctant to support an institution which may not have served them well. Perhaps their own parents parted, their own marriages have failed. But policy should not be made by personal anecdote or by the intrusion of therapeutic thinking into areas where it is not appropriate. What do I mean by that? Well, when you're seeking to help an individual with serious personal or family problems, it is quite justified to say people of your type can be successful. If I was looking at a single parent, I would say, you can make it and I'll help you make it. The only alternative is to say, give up now, and none of us would want to say that, would we? But the fact that something is appropriate in the context of therapy does not mean it is appropriate in the context of government policy. It may be right to say to a single mum, somebody like you can bring up your child well, but it doesn't follow that government should be neutral between family types or provide support for single parents in a way that undermines marriage or stable couple relationships. So we need also to send unambiguous messages to young people through relationship education in schools to provide them with a specific opportunity to learn about, explore, and discuss the nature of marriage, family, and relationships. Again, with this voluntary sector strongly encouraged to deliver many of these resources, just giving the teachers a bit of a break on a bit of a sensitive subject. Now, they need to know about the differences between marriage and cohabitation, for example. There's a very interesting strand of research being done in the States right now by a team of researchers from the University of Denver to test what has been called commitment theory. This theory suggests, and girls really need to know about this, cohabitation is a bad deal for women because of the way the sexes view commitment. For women, commitment is to do with attachment, the day-to-day intimacy of shared life, him making your meal, you washing his socks. So moving in together is a significant statement, but for men, it's about a decision. Will you marry me? Moving in together still leaves options agreeably open. This is what the research says. So very simply put, women appear to commit and sacrifice when they move in with a man, whereas men seem to commit when they make a decision to marry. It's really different. So women's commitment is based on attachment, men's more a decision. It may even have a basis in biology, anyway, like most things do. But many of these recommendations involve, to some extent, the involvement of outsiders in family life, which is somewhat resisted. But in Britain, we found that the breakdown of the nuclear family has also been accompanied by even more pronounced breakdown of the extended family. There's an absence of traditional sources of wisdom and experience previously found with the grandparents, with aunts and uncles. And this breakdown in the extended family coexists with incredibly high expectations for our marriages and families. What a lethal combination. So at this point in time, the skills to realize these high expectations often do need to be imparted from outside the family, especially where adults are unable to teach their children what they have never learned themselves. So, as a more relationally competent society emerges, parents will teach their children, etc., and the need for such services will eventually wither away. We're not talking about this being forever the case, necessarily. It's correcting something. So, to conclude, I believe we are at a vital juncture in the life course of Europe. Government policy, the voluntary sector, and other modern institutions need to be willing to talk about marriage without at each point treating it as identical to other relationship forms which have statistically different outcomes. A tiny minority of cohabitations last a lifetime. A significant majority of marriages do. This is not about being smug, it's about being realistic and research-based. We have to talk about marriage in a way that is appropriate for the times we are living in. Professor Bill Doherty, family scholar at the University of Minnesota, says, "Never use the term traditional marriage. You don't know what it means. It doesn't necessarily mean a certain gender arrangement with mothers at home, dads in the workplace. And opponents of the traditional family concept score easy hits by saying that marriage goes hand in hand with the breadwinner father, at-home mother model. Lots of people are pro-marriage, but don't buy into the gender stereotypes. They don't speak out explicitly for marriage because they don't like the package. And rarely does it fit nowadays for every stage of life. Now, I work and travel a lot now, but before my children went to school, I was full-time at home whilst my husband worked long hours and traveled the world. So let's not box women in, okay? It just makes the marriage thing a target. Doherty continues, "Like many others, I see a marriage renaissance coming. A movement towards something that has elements of the past, especially commitment and stability, but also some new features, such as gender equality, that weren't the strengths of the marriages of our forebears." So we're not going back. It's so uncool to talk about going back. We're going forward, re-envisioning marriage for the 21st century. And I just want to pause while that sinks in. The best days of marriage, I believe, are yet to come. We have to craft the message in such a way to emphasize there is nothing passé about an institution that looks after adults and children so well. We need to talk about the need to synthesizing the best of the old or traditional, if you like, if you have to use the word, aspects of marriage, as I say, expectations, longevity, commitment, durability, with the best of the new, equality, intimacy, companionship, all these things people do want. And I said, we need to reconceptualize marriage. It's about tempering narcissism, tempering the love of self with a sense of the greater project, which can be achieved by two people who kind of live by the principle, look after number two. That willingness to sacrifice will pervade the rest of life and benefit society in countless ways. And that is ultimately why well-functioning marriage is good for society. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a beautiful island. We're having a lovely time here, my husband and I. But I would urge you to maintain the reputation I mentioned earlier of showing the greatest support for the institution of marriage among other European nations. Please do not let the breakdown culture pervade your thinking the way Euro notes will kind of flood through your society in January 08. And one source I read said that the name Malta comes from the Punic word for harbour, and that your strategically positioned harbour has at times been your most valuable resource. Now, this painting is Merchant Ships at Anchor in Grand Harbour, Malta. It was painted in 1943 by Bernard Hailstone, one of the best periods of your history, I believe. And I would urge you, please continue to be a safe harbour for the institution of marriage. I believe you are strategic in Europe for this purpose. And I want to thank you again for inviting me to speak here. Thank you.
Dr. Callan, I think, ladies and gentlemen, you will all agree with me that was a truly, truly good talk, which gives us all an incredible amount of food for thought, I think. There was not one stretch of your presentation, I think, that could not in its own right be turned into an entire presentation. You could have very easily made out and presented another 20 presentations out of that one presentation, because I think all of us here today realize how important it is to look deep into what is happening around us, to look, especially here, of course, from a Maltese context, to see what it is that we can do, not only within our domestic context, as I have already mentioned in the beginning, but also perhaps we should now question, does Malta, can Malta, as a member of the European community, do something about this issue? If, as you have pointed out, we have been blessed and graced with being a country which has been picked out in terms of being one of those which greatly believes in marriage and the family unit, etc. If this is correct, and I have no doubt to doubt that, let us take advantage of this. Let us take advantage of it by making our voice heard wherever possible. And of course, this is where governments come into the equation. Perhaps it is about time that governments take a more active role in this and show the benefits through various forms of initiatives. Thank you very much, Dr. Callan, for that. I hope we shall be hearing more from you and of you in the future, because as I am sure you have realized, the presence here today of this very encouraging crowd is evidence of the fact that people want to hear more. People believe in a healthy marriage, and they want to hear more, and they want to participate more.
Campus FM għadu kem waslilkom taħdita organizzata mil-Caritas, mil-Kummissjoni Djoċezana Familja u l-Movement Takana. Il-sujġett kien For a Marriage Friendly Future. Din il-lecture saret minn Dr. Samantha Callan.